Let us take, for example, the sea in which a floating sponge is entirely submerged. Surrounding these sponges is a medium which supports life, and so the etheric world can be contrasted with water surrounding our Earth, except for the difference that the sponge absorbs only some of the water, whereas the etheric world is not only outside our Earth but inside as well. Interpenetrates is the only word we have to describe something real inside something else which is real, and it is on the surface of this etheric world we shall someday live. We are so made that in the physical body we are in harmony with physical surroundings. At death we leave our physical body and function in our etheric body. We pass into the new environment which surrounds us, an environment which supports life, just as water supports life. We on earth are in this sea of ether, though we know it not, and just as much now as we shall ever be. The difference death makes to us is not so much a change of location as a change of appreciation. We now only appreciate the physical, but then we shall appreciate the etheric. Only when we desire to do so shall we again get into touch with the physical, as the physical pertains to physical matter, and the etheric to etheric matter, each in its own order, the one difference being that they of the etheric world can come back to us at will, see us and appreciate us and our surroundings. We can but listen to what is told and try to imagine. We are like a blind person here on earth, as we cannot see these men and women of the etheric world. But conditions can be produced which enable us to hear them and from what we are told imagine as best we can. I have been told by them that our greatest thinkers have not the least conception of the properties that make up the universe. Our leaders of present-day thought, ignoring, as many of them do, the seance room and mediumship, are missing great opportunities for instruction. The orthodox thought of today holds the opinion that space is empty of other life. I say that it is not, but contains life and form and feature, because I have been told so by those who inhabit it, and surely they know more of their own country than we do. To refuse to examine the claims of psychic science, and receive instruction from those with greater knowledge and intelligence than we have, because the phenomena are contrary to what it is thought should be, is blind stupidity due to ignorance and prejudice. Chapter 3. Mind and Matter. Whatever that be which thinks, understands, wills and acts, it is something celestial and divine. Cicero. Today we can comprehend the universe in a way as never before. It may now be legitimately assumed that it had no beginning and will have no end, that the universe reduced to reality is motion, of which the speed of light is the only absolute speed we know, as all other speeds are relative. To say that the universe is just motion and nothing more seems to be reducing reality to absurdity, so let me put it thus. The universe is made up of varying degrees of motion, some of which appeal to us physical beings and are termed physical matter, while there is much which goes past us making no appeal to our senses. Constant change must be going on throughout this vast region, with physical matter radiating itself into non-visible matter, if we use the word matter for the effect this motion has on mind. Mind is the highest range of vibration we know. Those who look on the universe as made up only of physical matter, and nothing more, take the view that it is running down and someday physical matter will cease to exist. That, however, is a much too limited view. From my psychic experiences I prefer to consider physical matter as only part of the universe, and that just as the sun, for instance, is slowly radiating itself out of sight, so other worlds are forming by the slowing down of motion. Thus new physical worlds are gradually becoming visible to the physical eye. The universe is constantly changing, physical worlds, such as nebulae, being slowly born to be seen by us physical people, while others like the sun are going back again to the substance from which they came. It is so difficult to discuss a subject which resolves itself into motion, something so intangible, but matter is motion and motion is matter. Matter, therefore, is the universe, it makes up the universe, it is everywhere in the universe. There is no place anywhere where it is not, it never had a beginning, and it will never have an end. It is in constant movement, evolving or devolving from our point of view. There is no such thing as empty space. This matter, which in certain states of motion appeals to us as physical matter, in other states appeals to those in the etheric world, just as physical matter appeals to us. Consequently, they have their tangible world, on which things eve and grow, just as we have ours. How many different worlds or places of habitation there may be depends on mind. Without mind there is nothing, and only when mind is present is there any realization of matter, physical or etheric. It might therefore be logical to say that where mind is not, then there is no matter, that the universe therefore can be reduced to this one something, to which we give the name mind. But can we conceive mind without something to act upon? We only appreciate mind when acting on matter, so mind and matter, though different, one the active, the other the passive, must be correlated. The name we give to the substance which makes up the universe, namely matter, must therefore include these active and passive states. It must be dual in nature, as one without the other is impossible to imagine. So mind and matter are thus linked together, and to think of the one without the other is impossible. Mind, this something which appreciates matter and can influence matter, is the dominant force or motion in the universe. I must use the words force or motion, as I can find no others. Mind is as much a part of the universe as physical and etheric matter. It can have had no beginning, neither can it have an end. Its property is its capacity to develop and enlarge thought, or, in other words, it has the capacity of forming itself into images seen or imagined and of causing movement. To us, mind is experienced in conjunction with physical matter, and, as this book proceeds, it will be found in conjunction with etheric matter as well, but what its history is who can tell? We doubtless only experience mind in a limited form, and what it has performed in the past, or is performing elsewhere beyond our ken, no human being can say. Movement denotes mind. Is therefore all the motion which appeals to our senses, and to which we give the name matter, governed by mind? Where does the realm of mind? Universe. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal and unchangeable, we are told in the Scottish Shorter Catechism. Today, with our larger knowledge we might say more correctly, mind is infinite, eternal, always changing, always developing, always creating new forms from old and never at rest. Physical and etheric matter, governed by mind, thus make up the universe, and so far as is known there is nothing beyond or above. Wherever mind is, there will be found physical or etheric matter, and so it becomes impossible to imagine a limited universe because it must be as unlimited as mind cannot operate on nothing. Mind and matter must go together, no mind, then no matter. Consequently, so long as, and wherever mind exists, there must also be matter, the universe being limited only by the bounds of mind. Each one of us has his share of this universal mind, and its interaction with physical matter is evidently for the purpose of training it in mental image making. Mind has the peculiar faculty of forming, or molding itself into, the images and the movements of its surroundings. These it can reproduce at will, and, through the medium of physical matter, cause change and movement here on earth. In the etheric world it has the power of molding etheric matter in a more direct fashion, and, by thought, surrounding etheric matter can be changed into the forms which the mind images. Earth, then, is the training ground for mind which has become individualized. Here it is trained in image-making through contact with Earth's grosser surroundings, and, as it develops, it takes more and more control over its surroundings. When it ceases to function through physical matter, it takes greater and greater control of its surroundings in the etheric world, until ultimately we, as represented by our minds and our surroundings, become just as we think. The individual mind of each of us, our ego or ourself, is therefore trained in creative thought through contact with Earth, which training conditions our surroundings here and hereafter. The mind evidently never dies, but continues developing forever, and, with its increase in command over its surroundings, both space and time become of less and less account. My mind is me and your mind is you. It has been in existence for all eternity, though not so individualized. Addresses and spoke to the right people, who recognized them, and referred to intimate family affairs. Never once was a mistake made, and the darkness really increased the evidence in favor of the genuineness of the whole proceedings. Difficult as it would be to remember everyone's departed friends and relations, and their family affairs, in the light, it would be doubly so in the dark, because 15 people were present and the medium would have to remember exactly where each one was sitting. The voice on every occasion spoke in front of the person who recognized the name, the earth address and the details which were given. It was all very mystifying, and the fact that sometimes two or three voices spoke at once did not make it less so. There must be accomplices, I thought, and not only that but a regular system of gathering information. How it could be done in so thorough a manner, was the question, but yet, on the other hand, how could the dead speak? Even if they lived again, their physical vocal organs were certainly buried, and how could the atmosphere be vibrated without a physical bodily instrument? No, nothing so impossible could happen. I had heard of frauds and impostors, but never of the dead speaking, so the balance was certainly in favor of fraud. So ran my thoughts that memorable night of the 20th September 1918, when suddenly a voice spoke in front of me. I felt scared. A man sitting next to me said, "Someone wants to speak to you, friend." So I said, "Yes, who are you?" "Your father, Robert Downey Findlay," the voice replied, and then went on to refer to something that only he and I and one other ever knew on earth, and that other, like my father, was some years dead. I was therefore the only living person with any knowledge of what the voice was referring to. That was extraordinary enough, but my surprise was heightened when, after my father had finished, another voice gave the name of David Kidston, the name of the other person who on earth knew about the subject, and he continued the conversation which my father had begun. No spy system, however thorough, no impersonation by the medium or by any accomplices could be responsible for this, and, moreover, I was an entire stranger to everyone present. I did not give my name when I entered the room. I knew no one in that room and no one knew me or anything about me. 54. That was my first introduction to John C. Sloan and the direct voice, and after the séance was over I asked him if I could come back again, as I was anxious to know more about this subject. "Certainly any time you care to come I shall please to see you," was his reply, and I turned to someone standing near and asked how much I should pay Mr. Sloan. I have always remembered the reply. "If you suggest such a thing as paying him he will be deeply offended. He does this as a duty, not to make money out of his mediumship." That did not impress me as the method adopted by a fraud. How could a working man earning a few pounds a week, I wondered, afford the time and the money to gather all the information I heard given to the people present that evening? I was so impressed with my strange experience that I went home that night, and wrote till the small hours of the next morning a careful account of all that occurred at this my first séance, and this practice I have constantly adopted unless I had a stenographer present. Slowly, but steadily, I came to understand that what I thought was impossible was really possible, what I thought could not occur did occur, that those I thought were dead were very much alive, that they had bodies of finer texture but similar in form to our own, and that the medium gave off a substance which enabled them to materialize their etheric mouths and throats and tongues and again vibrate our atmosphere. Further, I learned that as physical life can only gather round it matter, in the initial stage before birth, in the dark, so darkness was required to enable materialization to take place from the substance drawn from the medium. This I learned only slowly and after I had given much time and thought to the subject, but before I tried to know how it was all accomplished I set myself to prove the medium's honesty. This I did in many ways, as will be mentioned as we proceed. After that first night many friends who had died spoke to me, giving their names and correct addresses on earth, and told me things which no one present except myself could have known. Then I thought it might all be telepathy, though how telepathy could vibrate the atmosphere as a voice, which I recognized, I could not understand. However, I wished to leave no stone unturned to get at the truth, and so I waited to see how long this theory would hold the field. It was not long till it, like the fraud theory, had also to go. Friends came and spoke to me, and told me things that not only no one present knew, but that I did not know myself, and never had known. These things I found on inquiry to be correct, so thought transference between my conscious or subconscious mind and that of the medium was ultimately ruled out. I next decided to take the first opportunity to sit beside the medium, and when a voice was speaking to put my ear right up to his mouth. I felt his hands from the beginning of the seance, and when a voice spoke I put my ear close to his mouth. I felt his breath, my ear and his lips were just touching, but not a sound was to be heard. This I have done, not once or twice, but many times, until finally I was convinced that the phenomenon of the direct voice was not only genuine but that those who spoke were those they said they were, our friends and relations, who, though parted from their physical garment, continue to live our life much as we do here. When able to gather sufficient ectoplasm from a human being, called by us a medium, they can, by lowering their vibrations, vibrate our atmosphere, speak to us, and hear us when we reply. After 12 years' intimate experience of Mr. John C. Sloan, and having sat with most of the other leading mediums in this country and America, I can say with conviction that he is the best trance, direct voice, clairvoyant and clairaudient medium with whom I have ever sat. Though trance utterances never appeal to me as does the direct voice, yet his powers in this direction are remarkable. His power of hearing clairaudiently is extraordinary, especially his faculty of getting the names and addresses of those speaking, a task which most mediums find difficult to do. If he had been willing to give his gifts to the public, he would have been known as one of this country's most famous mediums. Instead of this, he has preferred having his friends to his house for an evening, once a week or so, and giving them the pleasure of meeting again those of their acquaintances who have passed beyond the veil. He is retiring to a degree and modest in the extreme. He cares nothing for the praise which so often comes at the end of such an evening. He always gives me the impression that he dislikes these seances and only holds them as a duty. I know that, if left to himself, he would never exercise his mediumistic faculties. His sense of duty and kindness of heart are the reasons why his friends have been so specially privileged. I know no man more honorable, of kinder nature, or with more of the old Scottish type of independence. So long as he can get work, he will never take money in exchange for his gift. He has his ups and downs, and, though a good and trustworthy workman, he has been out of work occasionally through no fault of his own. On one occasion, Mr. McCulley, some of whose experiences are recorded in Chapter 10, who was one of the regular attenders at his weekly seances, told me that when Mr. Sloan had been out of work for some time, a proposal was made that he should take something from those who came, and that they would bring others also who would gladly pay. Very reluctantly he agreed to give 3 seances on these terms, but after the second he refused to give the last. "I have now got a job," was his reply, "and I shall never again take money for my mediumship, if I can get work to enable me to support my family." The third seance was, however, held only on the condition that no payment was made. Such is John C. Sloan, quixotic, yes, stubborn, yes, but only in what to him is a matter of conscience. No one need ask him for permission to be present at a seance and fear refusal, no one need fear that he will be made to feel that a favor is being granted. To Sloan, his duty is to give his gift to those who need it, but no money need be offered, as it would not be accepted. It may be considered extraordinary that a man with such gifts should be so little known, but this is entirely due to his modesty and retiring disposition. He hates publicity of any kind. He is so shy that on occasions, when I have asked him to give my own friends a sitting in the seance room at the offices of the Glasgow Society for Psychical Research, he has asked me not to introduce him, just to let him come in, take his seat and then have the lights put out. He is at his ease only when in his own house, his own friends gathered round him, and the seance takes the form of a religious meeting, as to him it is a holy communion with the unseen. His reward, he says, is in sending away some sorrowing one with the knowledge that life continues beyond this world, and that he has the means of bringing together a bereaved mother or widow and a son or husband who has passed into the beyond, to see their happiness, after he comes out of trance at the end of a séance, is to him ample reward for all his trouble. Hundreds upon hundreds have received this comfort and consolation through his instrumentality. He only claims to be an instrument, lie says he knows nothing as to how it all comes about. He has read little on the subject, and, as he is entranced throughout the séance, he knows nothing of what takes place. Had Sloane been made in a different mold, he could have made an easy living by his gift and become known as one of our most famous mediums, but he has been content to live simply by the labor of his hands, earning a few pounds a week. He has brought up a large family in a small, but comfortable house in one of the working-class districts of Glasgow, and often he has had a hard struggle to make ends meet. He performs his daily work conscientiously and well, and his employer, who often was present at his meetings, considered him one of his best and the most trustworthy workmen. Such is the man I met that evening, now over 12 years ago. I was then ushered into a small room, in which were gathered over a dozen people, and, after some preliminary conversation, we sat down in a circle, Sloane on the music stool beside a small harmonium. The lights were put out, and the room was in complete darkness. After a preliminary prayer, Sloane turned round and played several hymns in which we all joined, but before the last was finished he became controlled by an entity who goes under the picturesque name of White a Feather. He was usually addressed by us as Whitey, a most amusing personality, who says that when on earth he was a Red Indian chief, that he lived in the Rockies and consequently thinks our Scottish scenery tame in comparison. During the sitting Sloane, so far as I could judge, remained seated on the stool. Voices of all degrees of strength and culture spoke, from what appeared to be all parts of the room, but it was difficult to say where they actually originated, as in the center of the circle were two megaphones, or trumpets, each about 2.5 feet long, and from the metallic ring of the voice it was evident that they were occasionally being used to speak through. All the time the two trumpets, one not being used to speak through, went round the circle touching each one gently. Someone would be lightly touched on the point of the nose, another on the top of the head, Anthea's hand would be touched, and so on, never a hard knock. At request, any part of the body would be touched without a mistake, without any fumbling, a clean, gentle touch, an impossible feat for any human being to do in pitch darkness, as I have proved on various occasions. At times they moved so fast over our heads that they caused a swishing sound. Lights, about the size of half crowns, of a phosphorescent appearance, were moreover continually moving about the room at all angles. Looking over my records, I find that I have notes of 43 different séances at which either I or my friends had conversations with those who claim to have known us when on earth, 39 of which have been with Sloane, 4 with other mediums. I have also witnessed, at different times, the same phenomena with the leading direct voice mediums, both in this country and in the United States, so I think I may claim to have sufficient experience to enable me critically to examine the phenomena and record my conclusions. As I say, I have notes of 39 different séances with Sloane, 83 separate voices have spoken to me, or to personal friends I have brought with me, and 282 separate communications have been given to me or them. 180 of these I class A1, as it was impossible for the medium or any other person present to have known the facts then given. 100 I class as A2, as by means of the newspaper or reference books the medium could have found them out. One item of information given me I have not had the opportunity of verifying, and only one I have found to be incorrect. This latter was right up to a point, but, as it was a message given me by a voice on behalf of another, it is possible it was wrongly delivered. If it had been delivered in a slightly altered form it would have been correct, so I think that this one exception need not invalidate in any way the other items I have had correctly given. Within the last few years changes have occurred in Sloane's life. His daughters married, his sons went to sea, and he consequently found living alone monotonous. His wife's people were seafaring folk, and his sons followed the same calling. He also had a longing all his life for the same life, and, as he had no ties to keep him on shore, he likewise followed his sons and joined an Atlantic liner as master at arms, a position which he held for some years when he decided to come and live again on shore. He is now employed with one of the leading business houses in Glasgow, but continues to give seances to his friends. Only occasionally, however, does he now exercise his gift of mediumship, as his health is not so good as it used to be. As I have already said, it seems strange that a man of such exceptional gifts should, for all practical purposes, be unknown to the world, but so it is. It can only be attributed to his persistent refusal to accept money and become a public medium, and nothing will change him from this course. He writes to me at times and I hear of him through mutual friends, but we seldom meet now, as, living in England land as I now do, I am only occasionally in Scotland. I have, however, my notes to remind me of the many interesting and instructive times I spend in his presence, and all my life I shall be grateful to him for the kindness and courtesy he has always shown me. I look back on the night we first met, and feel that I was there in the position of one who was looking for something which lack of knowledge had prevented me from finding. That night he gave me the chance of discovering what I had been seeking, the proof positive that we still live beyond this narrow veil called life, and that, when the end of earth life comes, we not only enter a larger and fuller one but also join again those we once loved here. For this, my lifelong gratitude will be felt towards John C. Sloane. Chapter 5. The Seance. Science is bound by the everlasting law of honor to face fearlessly every problem which can fairly be presented to it. Galvin. The reader has now been introduced to the medium, so the next step forward is to describe what takes place at a seance. What parts do the medium and the sitters play? The medium, in this case, lives in a small but comfortable house near one of the busiest thoroughfares of the city, but quite far enough away to be clear of the noise of the ceaseless traffic. The door of his house leads the visitor into a passage, and on the left-hand side there is a bedroom and a kitchen. On the right-hand side is his sitting room, where the seances are held. Usually from 10 to 15 people gather on such occasions, but the arrangements are not made by the medium. He takes no part in arranging who are to be present. Mr. McCully, who holds a responsible position in a leading Glasgow business, took the responsibility of making up the gatherings. Those present varied week by week, and usually half the company were people who had come for the first time or had only been occasionally before. The nucleus of the circle only was composed of regular sitters, and these helped in the results because it will always be found that those who sit regularly are able to help by influencing the conditions. Harmony is the most essential condition necessary for a successful séance, and I have always found that the best results are obtained when those present are in sympathy with each other and when only good feeling exists. When people are present who dislike each other, or are flustered or in any way excited, the conditions are adversely affected. For that reason it is unwise for a party of novices to gather together in the presence of a highly developed medium, and expect good results for the first nine. That is impossible, and for this reason it was always found wise to have as many regular visitors as possible to keep conditions good, and yet allow strangers to come and get the experience, or the comfort, such a séance gives. The regular sitters have passed through the doubting and skeptical stage, the stage that every thinking person goes through. They have had their own experiences of their friends' return. They maintain a placid attitude, and this helps to counteract any adverse influence produced by the strangers present. Those who attend séances are always hearing about vibrations. Even outside the séance room we are becoming accustomed to think in terms of vibrations, and the discovery of wireless transmission has done more to educate the public on the question of vibrations than any other discovery made by man. We have already discussed the ether, and every thinking person knows that our radio set will not give such good results some days as on others. However good the transmission may be, and however good our receiving set may be, It can be adversely affected by what are called oscillations. Now, the person who oscillates and annoys us in this manner upsets our wireless conditions just as does the person who goes into a séance room hostile or angry.